When you walk by a movie theater, one thing that you'll encounter are a bunch of movie posters. Movie posters usually follow a common formula. Generally, you'll see the title in big, bold letters so that you could see it from far away and you know what the name of the movie is. Of course, if this movie has very famous actors in it, you'll see their faces placarded right there on the poster, because if you know a certain person is in that movie, you might be more inclined to go watch that movie. And then sometimes, especially if the actors aren't very well known, or if the movie is more story-driven, you'll oftentimes find quotes on the poster from movie critics, letting them you know how much these critics love the movie and all the accolades that have been given to this movie. For example, you'll find statements like, best film of the year, unique and unforgettable, a brilliant masterpiece, truly the most epic movie of the last decade, stunning, a must-see. And those are real quotes taken from movie posters, by the way. Some posters are just covered with these sort of awards and reviews from movie critics. They want you to know that this movie is worth watching. Not because it had the biggest budget or the most intense action sequences, but because the story and direction is powerful and beautiful. Certain movies are just gripping and wonderful in that way. One could argue that the Book of Ruth in the Old Testament is one of those works that deserves such a movie poster, because it really is a powerful and beautiful story. One author describes Ruth as one of the most delightful literary compositions of the ancient world. Another writer describes Ruth as a charming tale of human devotion and kindness, one of the most beautiful in the entire Old Testament, constituting a model of the art of storytelling. You could actually imagine that being on a movie poster, right? And I would have to agree. Ruth really is a delightful book which tells an engaging story. It has a great setting, interesting characters, a suspenseful plot, and touches on many issues that we still find relevant today, because we still live in a broken, hurting world. In this book, you'll encounter a beautiful tale of faithfulness, trust, and kindness, both on a human level and, of course, a divine level. And we have the privilege of studying this book this morning. Ruth, you'll find it in the 8th book in the Old Testament, right after Judges. It's a very short book, consisting of only 4 chapters. To read through this book in one sitting, it would probably take you only 10 to 15 minutes. That's so easy, right? Press your Staples Easy button right there. So now you should have no excuse for reading a book of the Old Testament. So what's Ruth about? Well, let's go ahead and turn to the introduction. Ruth chapter 1. And let's read the first few verses here so we could get acquainted with the plot. Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. Now it came about in the days when the judges governed that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and his 2 sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife, Naomi. And the names of his 2 sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem in Judah. Now they entered the land of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her 2 sons. They took for themselves Moabite women as wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other, Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and the woman was bereft of her two children and her husband. As you can see, this book begins with difficulty and disaster. Very quickly, we are introduced to two of our main characters, an Israelite named Naomi and her daughter-in-law named Ruth. In response to the famine that struck the land of Judah, Naomi's husband, Elimelech, decides to move his family to the land of Moab. This is where their two sons find wives for themselves, two Moabite women named Orpah and Ruth. And sadly, while they're living in this foreign land, Naomi experiences tremendous heartbreak. She loses her husband and her two sons. All that remains at the end of verse 5 are three grieving, childless widows who only have each other to lean upon. Elimelech no longer has anyone to carry on his family name, which was a big deal in ancient Israel. And now Naomi's very survival is in question. Without husband or children, she would have to figure out a way to provide for herself in the midst of a famine. And so hopefully you could sense the sadness here, the tension of the story. What are these ladies going to do about their situation? The rest of this book is devoted to resolving this dilemma, telling us the story of how these sad, dejected widows will survive in ancient Israel. Thankfully, these women do survive, and we'll see how it happens. But in summary, on a human level, you could say that Naomi and Ruth survive because of personal faith and kindness. And on a divine level, we could say that they survive because of God's sovereignty and his even greater kindness. This concept of kindness is what primarily dominates the story of Ruth, flowing richly between the main characters and especially from God to mankind. And I believe this faith and kindness constitute the primary ways that God would want us to benefit as we study the book of Ruth this morning. And so first of all, I believe the book of Ruth should encourage you to, point number one, follow God at all times. Follow God at all times, even when life gets difficult. Ruth encourages us to remain faithful and follow God even when life hurts, because the Lord sustains those who seek him. Look at verse 1 again. Did you notice the setting of this book? The author says that these events came to pass in the days when the judges governed. In other words, this story happened during the time period that we talked about last week, during the time described in the book of Judges. If you were here last week, you might remember that Judges covers a very dark period in Israel's history. The nation largely turned away from the Lord and started to serve false gods. It was a time when everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Faith was rare, and sin was rampant. As a result, you might wonder if these characters in the book of Ruth would actually follow God. I mean, they're living there in the midst of this people who have largely abandoned faith. And initially, it doesn't look promising, as we read in the first verses of this book. The sons of Judah, they're being punished with a famine, which is one of the curses that God promised upon the people if they would turn away from the Lord. And this family in particular, instead of turning to the Lord, they actually abandoned the land that was promised to Abraham and his descendants, and they decide to live in Moab. And so faith does not seem to be strong at the beginning of this book. Interestingly, the first great expression of faith that we encounter and commitment to follow God doesn't come from an Israelite, but actually from this young Moabite woman named Ruth. While God's people are largely abandoning faith, God has done a work in this young woman's life so that she would turn to God. And that's one thing that makes this book so encouraging, because while so many people, the nation at large, is turning away from the Lord during the time of the judges, God still has his remnant of believers. And interestingly, he works in this Moabite woman. So let's continue to read the story and notice especially how Ruth responds to her dark circumstances. Verse 6. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the land of Moab. For she had heard in the land of Moab that the Lord had visited his people in giving them food. So she departed from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. May the Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "No, but we will surely return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return, my daughters. Why should you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Return, my daughters. Go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I said I have hope, if I should even have a husband tonight and also bear sons, would you therefore wait until they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is harder for me than for you, for the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me." And they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Then she said, "Behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." So notice what's happening here. It's been 10 years since Naomi and her family left Judah to reside in Moab. And so this famine was going on for a very long time. And at the end, she hears this report that the Lord had visited his people and was providing food for them once again. And so she's determined to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi, she isn't filled with much hope here. You could see it. She's unsure as to whether she's going to face blessing or more hardship when she returns to Judah. And so she actually encourages her two daughters-in-law to return to their respective families in Moab and hopefully find another husband to marry. In verse 10, Orpah and Ruth are initially inclined to follow Naomi back to Judah, but Naomi continues to try to convince them against doing so. In verse 11, she makes reference to God's provision for situations like this. As she mentions having children of her own, basically in a situation like this, if you know the Pentateuch, when an Israelite woman was widowed and she had no children, the husband's brother was supposed to take her as his wife. And the firstborn son would then be raised up in the name of the original husband so that his name would not be blotted out from Israel. But Naomi mentions here that she doesn't have any other sons to take on this role. Even if she did get married and had sons tomorrow, she says, would Orpah, by the way, Oprah's original name, I knew I would make a mistake here. And I'm sure you're thinking that as you're reading this book. Her original name on her birth certificate, by the way, is actually Orpah, by the way. And she changed it because people had a difficult time pronouncing her name to Oprah. And so forgive me if I make that mistake. So even if Naomi did have sons tomorrow, would Orpah and Ruth wait another 15 to 20 years for these sons to grow up so that they could actually get married to Naomi's other sons so that they could become their husbands? And so at the end of verse 13, Naomi expresses that they should just go back, and she even brings up her own personal situation. "My situation is even harder than your situation, ladies." Because at this point, Naomi is probably in her 50s. So she even has less hope of remarrying and having children. She even concludes that God's hand has turned against her. So why should these two ladies want to follow her back to Israel. And it was definitely right for Naomi to recognize God's sovereignty in this situation. But at the same time, her attitude is quite sad because she hardly has any hope in what God can do in the midst of all this darkness. Orpah listens to Naomi's voice, and she actually returns to her mother's household. But Ruth clings to Naomi. She will not abandon her mother-in-law. And in verse 16, she gives one of the most beautiful and memorable expressions of faith in the entire Bible. These are probably the most famous verses in the book. Verse 16, "Do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you and me." This statement is a big deal. For one thing, it was an incredible act of kindness and commitment that Ruth would be willing to follow Naomi and essentially bind her destiny to Naomi's. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Just as I have shared in your grief, I am determined to continue sharing in your life and in every future experience of yours. Whether blessing or suffering awaits, I am with you. Even unto death, I will be buried with you. And this was an incredible statement of commitment. Besides this amazing commitment to Naomi, Ruth makes an even bigger decision. This wasn't just about her moving to another country. She was making a decision to follow the Lord, to completely switch her allegiance from the gods of Moab to the one true God. Since they were living in the time of Judges, Ruth probably could have kept right on worshiping the gods of Moab, even in the land of Israel, because as we saw last week, the sons of Israel themselves were already worshiping the Baals and the Ashtaroth and the gods of Aram and the gods of Sidon and the gods of Moab. That's what Samuel says. But Ruth decides to give up those gods in order to serve the Lord. "Your people shall be my people and your God, my God." This event should be slightly reminiscent of Rahab in the book of Joshua. Do you remember Rahab? She was the woman from the city of Jericho who hid the spies in her house. She was the woman who heard a report about the Lord, how he was determined to give Canaan to the Israelites, how the Lord dried up the Jordan, and he utterly destroyed the two Amorite kings that were before them. And so in response to this report, Rahab believed. She was willing to make the Lord her God, and as a result, her family was spared. And she actually ended up playing a key role in God's plan to bring Jesus Christ into the world. Ruth is doing a very similar thing here. She must have heard about the Lord, probably from Naomi's family or some other source. And she probably didn't know too much at this point, but what she did hear about the Lord, she was willing to believe and follow. So strong was Ruth's commitment to Naomi that she even summons the Lord to be witness against her and pronounces that the Lord can judge me if I break this pledge. Her words left Naomi speechless. Ruth's response is truly surprising on many levels. And I think she offers us a wonderful example for us to consider today. While Ruth's trials were certainly difficult and heartbreaking, she could look back on these days and praise the Lord because God used these events to draw her closer to him. And I know many of you have a similar testimony. How God has used painful circumstances to draw you near to him. And that is the greatest reward, isn't it? To have more of Christ. Of course, that statement isn't meant to minimize the pain we experience, but rather to just view that pain from the perspective of God's good and sovereign grace. So in the next few verses, Naomi and Ruth make their way back to Judah. Let's go ahead and read the last several verses of this chapter, verse 19. So they both went until they came to Bethlehem. And when they had come to Bethlehem, all the city was stirred because of them. And the woman said, "Is this Naomi?" She said to them, "Do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me?" Here you could see just how brokenhearted Naomi was. Naomi's name actually means pleasant, but she would rather be known as Mara, which means bitter. She feels like she went out full 10 years ago, but now upon returning to Judah, she feels totally empty. Wow, what a sentiment. And maybe that's how some of you feel about your own life. Maybe 10 years ago, 5 years ago, even just a year ago, life felt totally full and you were content. But then something happened that changed your life forever. Well, if you're a believer, Christ would want you to know that you could trust him and hope in his sovereign plan that has not yet been fully manifested to you yet. Believers are not exempt from suffering. We see that in this book. But you who have a gracious God who is part of that suffering and who knows what he's doing. And we could commend Naomi here for at least this aspect of her theology. She knew that the Lord was behind her circumstances. It was the Lord who afflicted her, as she says in verse 21. The Almighty has done this to me. And it is true. The Almighty did put her in this position. But that's not the only statement that applies in her situation, is it? There are so many other truths that have a bearing on her circumstances, which she could have meditated on as well. For example, imagine that someone invites you over to dinner and they serve you a wonderful 3-course meal. Appetizer, salad, and a delicious main dish. But they don't set out dessert for you. And so, you and your spouse, you're going home, and all you're talking about is how they forgot to give you dessert. I can't believe they forgot the dessert. And that is true. You could definitely say they forgot the dessert. That does apply to your situation. But what about the first 3 courses? Have you forgotten about that reality? I think our suffering can cause us to focus so much on what's missing rather than on what's there. On what God did today, rather on who he is yesterday, today, and yes, tomorrow as well. In fact, notice Naomi's words there in verse 21 again. The Lord has brought me back empty. Was she really empty? Did she really have nothing? First of all, she has the Lord, whom she could turn to at all times. But notice how the author answers her feelings in the very next verse. Verse 22. So Naomi returned, and with her Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, who returned from the land of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. Was she really empty? The author says, not really. She's not seeing it, but she's not really empty. She returned to Judah with Ruth the Moabitess. She ignored the fact that standing right next to her was this woman who would become actually the source of her very survival and her joy in the coming days. Ruth would be the key to filling up all her lacks, and yet she was too blinded by her bitterness to see it. She also couldn't see that she was actually returning to Judah during God's season of blessing, during the barley harvest, which would play a key role in the coming chapters. Now, when you think of Ruth herself, she was actually a woman who could sympathize with Naomi. She also lost her husband. She had no children. But we don't see her complaining. And she definitely isn't ready to give up. In fact, at the beginning of chapter 2, we find Ruth demonstrating her faith by committing to Naomi by working hard. Naomi herself is too old to go work in the fields, and so Ruth goes. She becomes the provider, as it were, for this little family unit they have going. She submits herself to God's law and Naomi's advice, and she goes gleaning in the grain fields. Now, what does it mean to glean? Well, in the book of Leviticus, God told his people, the farmers in his land, that they shouldn't reap to the very edges of their field, and they shouldn't pick every last bit of their crops. They were supposed to leave a little bit behind so that the poor and the aliens in their midst could pick those and have something to eat. It was kind of like God's built-in system of welfare, of taking care of the poor in their midst. God instituted this practice as a means of taking care of the needy in their society. And Ruth, she works so hard in one day that she's able to bring home, volume-wise, about 5 gallons of barley back home. Despite her suffering, she wasn't ready to throw in the towel. Instead, she responded by committing herself to Naomi, committing her ways to the Lord, taking advantage of the resources that God was providing. And I think this is how God would want us to respond, especially when trials come. Do you remember how in the book of Judges we studied last week, how God left the surrounding nations in place so that he might test Israel by those nations? The Israelites largely failed the test. They turned away from the Lord. And that's exactly how some people respond to the trials that strike their life. They say, forget all this Christian stuff. Forget all this ministry. I'm done with it. I'm just going to bury myself in sports now, self-improvement, hobbies. Because this Christian stuff, prayer, reading the Bible, it just doesn't work. Well, that's not the right way to respond to the difficulties in your life. We're not Christians because it works. We're Christians because Christ is supreme. He's lovely. He's supreme in authority and supreme in beauty. And he died for you. He loved you first, and so we love him, and we want more of him. That's why we're Christians. It's not ultimately for what Christ gives us, but because of who he is. And of course, he does promise to give us good things. We may have to wait till heaven to receive the blessings that he's promised. But he does even show his kindness to us in the land of the living. We're just sometimes too stuck in our perspective to see it. And so Ruth offers us a positive example of how we ought to respond when difficulty comes. Be even more determined to follow him and submit to his ways. The Lord, he's always beautiful and always worthy to be served in every season of life. And he's our only hope of finding fulfillment despite our brokenness. Now, not only should the book of Ruth encourage you to follow God at all times, but I think Ruth should also encourage you, secondly, to be kind to one another. Be kind to one another, especially to those facing adversity. We've already seen Ruth display a great amount of kindness to her mother-in-law by devoting herself to Naomi, even unto death. But in chapter 2, we're introduced to another character who displays an incredible amount of kindness towards these ladies. Chapter 2, we meet a man named Boaz. Let's read about him. Chapter 2, verse 1. Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, "Please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I may find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, "May the Lord be with you." And they said to him, "May the Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to his servant, who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" The servant in charge of the reapers replied, "She is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab." And she said, "Please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves." Then she came and has remained from the morning until now. She has been sitting in the house for a little while. Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go on from this one, but stay here with my maids. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. When you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants draw." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" Boaz replied to her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me. Now how you left your father and your mother and the land of your birth and came to a people that you did not previously know. May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge." So as the passage mentions, Boaz is a relative of Elimelech. So he's aware of Naomi and Ruth's situation and their great need. Now, even in that, even though he is related, he could have easily turned a blind eye to their need. After all, the nation at large was abandoning faith and not keeping God's law. And the land itself had just come out of a serious famine. So Boaz could have been tempted to try to hoard all his crops, saying, "I need to be prepared in case a famine strikes the land again. I can't be giving this stuff away. This is valuable." But notice, he totally opens up his heart to Ruth. Notice all the kindness he shows towards them. He encourages Ruth to glean only from his field, not to pick from any other one. "It's okay if you take all your gleanings from mine. I'm okay with that." He commands his workers to treat her with respect, to not rebuke her while she's gleaning. He even tells them to pull out some grain from their bundles so that Ruth would have extra to glean. Boaz even invites her to join them at mealtime. Boaz's kindness was so great that it shocked Ruth in verse 10. We saw her reaction. She wonders, "Why have I found favor in your sight?" You know, it's very possible that Ruth just hasn't been the object of much personal kindness since her husband passed away how many years ago? Especially when you consider that she's now a foreigner living in this new land of Israel. A lot of people probably looked at her and didn't want to talk to her and just saw her go by, weren't being directly kind to her. And so now she's just totally floored that someone would demonstrate such incredible kindness towards her. Boaz's kindness continues in chapter 3. We won't read this passage, but the harvest. So time has passed by from chapter 2 to chapter 3. The harvest now is almost complete. But of course, what does that mean? It means that the time for gleaning is almost over. How would Naomi and Ruth survive during the winter months if they have no crops to glean from, no harvest to glean from? They didn't have any resources to work with. Their family had already sold the land, and so they don't have a land to rely upon for income. And even looking further into the future, for Ruth, she would be extremely vulnerable in the coming years if she didn't find a husband, because all Ruth had in the land was Naomi. And so if Naomi were to pass away, then Ruth would have nobody. She would be absolutely alone, totally vulnerable. And so it was important for Naomi and Ruth to figure something out very soon. But that's where Boaz steps in. First of all, Boaz fulfills the role of what's called kinsman redeemer. I'll explain that in a second. He basically agrees to purchase back their family land. And so with this land back in the family, the ladies would have a better chance at surviving in the future. But secondly, Boaz gladly agrees to take Ruth as his wife. Naomi, you could tell that she's familiar with God's law and the Jewish custom of the levirate marriage. Basically, that's what we talked about earlier, where a man would marry his brother's widow and would raise up children in his name. Boaz probably wasn't a brother of Elimelech, but he was a close enough relative such that they could ask him to fulfill this custom. Interestingly, though, Naomi, if you think about it, is actually Elimelech's widow, right? Not Ruth. And so under normal circumstances, Naomi should ask Boaz to be her husband. But by this time, Naomi, she's most likely past childbearing age, and she's actually more interested in looking after Ruth's future security. Look at the beginning of chapter 3. The first verse of chapter 3 says, "Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, 'My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well for you?'" And so Naomi is desiring Ruth's future well-being. And hence, she passes up her right to marry Boaz so that Ruth would be cared for in the future. And so what ends up happening, and there's a lot of interesting customs. You guys got to read this book on your own, okay? I don't have time to explain all the interesting customs that go on here. But what ends up happening is Boaz, he purchases back the land, and he joyfully takes Ruth as his wife and submits to God's law in raising up a son in Elimelech's name, or in this case, Mahlon, who would have been Ruth's husband. Look at chapter 4, verse 9. These verses summarize what Boaz did. "Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, 'You are witnesses today that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. Moreover, I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up in the name of the deceased on his inheritance, so that the name of the deceased will not be cut off from his brothers or from the court of his birthplace. You are witnesses today.'" Now, after encountering so much sin and so much failure in the Bible up to this point, this book is a refreshing bit of fresh air, isn't it? It totally stands out, but in a very good way. In this book, you actually find people who care for each other, and they're respecting each other. Sadly, this should not have been the exception. When you study the Pentateuch, you come to understand that this sort of kindness should have characterized Israelite society as a whole. The entire nation should have enjoyed these sort of relationships if they only committed themselves to God's word. That's because God's law isn't just a bunch of commands pertaining to religious ceremony and practices like that. Rather, God's law is fundamentally about loving God and loving your neighbor as yourself. And God still expects his people today to show kindness towards one another, following in the footsteps of Boaz and Ruth. Love and compassion must characterize your life if you're a believer. Why is that the case? Well, let's just take Boaz as an example. Do you know why God commanded the Israelites to show kindness to the poor by allowing them to glean in their fields, by not reaping to the edge of their fields? Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 24 real quick. Keep your finger here. We'll come back to Ruth, of course, but Deuteronomy chapter 24. Just turn a few books back. Verse 19, here in Deuteronomy 24. When you reap your harvest in your field, and have forgotten a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow, in order that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive tree, you shall not go over the boughs once again. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not go over it again. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow. And so here we see one of those places in the Pentateuch where God was commanding the Israelites to care for the orphan and the alien in their midst. They should leave. You know, basically they beat their olive tree. It makes all the olives fall down. But then there's still some olives left, for example, right? Well, God says, save those. Let the poor person come by and pick those olives so that they could have something to eat. I mean, it really is a lot of kindness that's built into God's law. It's wonderful, isn't it? But why? Why is God commanding the Israelites to do this? Look at verse 22. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I am commanding you to do this thing. God says, remember your history. Recall your own great need. Remember that you were slaves. Remember how you needed compassion, and I gave you that compassion. Remember how I heard your groaning, and I didn't just stand by with a cold heart to you. I came to your aid. I used all my divine resources to lift you up. This is why I want you to show kindness to one another, because of what I have done in your life. Or to use Jesus' words in the book of Matthew, where he says, love your neighbor and even love your enemies. Why? So that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good. In other words, the Lord wants you to be kind because he wants you to reflect his own kind character. He wants you to be like him. He wants you to be holy even as he is holy. He wants you to reflect his love even as he has loved you. And so therefore, show kindness to one another. What does this mean to be kind, to be compassionate? Well, compassion assumes that someone is in need. And so ask yourself this question. How do you respond when you find out about a need? What is your typical response? Are you inclined to help out? Or do you get angry? Do you walk away? Do you have to be guilt-tripped into serving others who are in need? Or are you just motivated to respond? And by the way, I don't think you should just be merely inclined to help out. Do you actually take the initiative to figure out people's needs and do something about it? The reason I say that this is important to think about, is because it's so easy to keep people at arm's length, isn't it? So that you never find out about their needs. And so, since I don't know about any needs, I'm not obligated to meet any needs. And yet you think you're such a kind person, and yet you're just justifying your uncompassionate heart with ignorance. Is that how God treated you? Did he choose to keep you at arm's length? Boaz's example should also remind us to show kindness to people who are different than us. Not only is it easy to keep people at arm's length, so I don't know about your needs, and so therefore I don't have to serve your needs, but it's also easy to target our compassion. Only being kind to people who are like me, being in the same social class, same age group, for example. Boaz was willing to bless a poor, childless Moabite widow. Can you imagine two people being more different than Ruth and Boaz? And yet he still opened up his heart towards her. Boaz has left us a great example to follow. Do you have a place in your heart for people who are not like you? Whether young or old, rich or poor, for the widows, the aged, those from a different culture. Are you willing to serve the poor, childless Moabite woman in your life? The angry child with no Christian parents? The thug who just got saved? The aged person who needs help doing practically everything nowadays? Will you draw near to them? Will you show kindness to them? You know, in a church this size, there are many opportunities to show kindness to one another. Join a home fellowship group, and you're going to discover needs every week. You could also talk to the brothers and sisters who lead the Safe Families Ministry, the Care Ministry, the New Hope Ministry, and the Compassion Ministry. If you want to discover more particular ways to exercise your kindness muscles. Every time you show kindness, you're reflecting the kind heart of your Lord, and you're helping others to better see and appreciate his glory. That in itself should excite you at the opportunity to take the initiative in showing kindness to others. I mean, consider just how floored Ruth was. Just amazed that this man would show kindness to her. Certainly that brought her closer to the Lord, didn't it? That made her worship at the Lord's feet. You could play that role in someone's life who's also in adversity if you take the initiative in showing kindness to them. Now, while we see all this kindness flowing between Boaz, Ruth, Naomi, there is no one who excels the Lord in kindness. This is probably the primary lesson we ought to learn as we study Ruth. And so finally, point three this morning, I would exhort you to worship the Lord. Worship the Lord because no one is kinder than him. The Lord is seen throughout this book as the fountain, the source of all the good things that we experience in our lives. You can see it throughout the book as the Lord orchestrates circumstances so that the land of Judah would suddenly no longer be in famine, so that Naomi and Ruth would return to Judah during the barley harvest, so that Ruth would happen to stumble upon Boaz's field as she was gleaning, and so that the closer relative, there was actually a relative closer than Boaz who could have taken up the role of kinsman redeemer and purchased the land and taken Ruth as a wife, but he gave up that right by God's sovereignty so that Boaz can do it instead. These weren't just happy coincidences. Our sovereign Lord was working out his good plan for Naomi and Ruth. Actually, many of these events were just completely out of their control, if you think about it. Yes, Ruth did work hard. She went to the field and gleaned, but they couldn't control the seasons. They couldn't control the produce of the land. They couldn't control their own ability to have children. Why is it that Naomi only had two sons? And why is it that Ruth and Orpah, they couldn't have any children while living in the land of Moab? The Lord wanted to do something even more marvelous and surprising than anything these ladies could imagine. The characters themselves, they acknowledge that the Lord is the source of these blessings throughout the book. Look at chapter 2, Ruth chapter 2. Verse 12. This is Boaz's blessing upon Ruth, his prayer. May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. So notice, Boaz understands that any reward for our labor comes from the Lord. He's the source of all this. Verse 20. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed of the Lord who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and to the dead. This is how Naomi responds after Ruth comes home with this great gleaning stockpile. Look how she refers to the Lord. She basically calls him the one who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and to the dead. That's who our God is. He's the one who has not forgotten us. He's not withdrawn his kindness from us. This goodness that we're experiencing, notice she doesn't give the glory to Boaz, even though it was Boaz's field that he allowed Ruth to glean from. Even on a human level, it was him that was the source of the blessing. No, she says, God be blessed. The Lord be blessed. This is really his kindness that we are experiencing right now. And notice what the author says about Ruth's ability to have children. Look at chapter 4. Verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. And so back in Moab, it wasn't God's will for Ruth to have children. But here, the Lord enables her to conceive. The glory doesn't belong to Boaz's reproductive system. The author clearly indicates that this blessing was from the Lord. And so all the characters agree that every good thing given and every perfect gift is from above. Therefore, God deserves the praise for every good thing we enjoy in life. Now, this does not mean that every believer gets to be married. This does not mean that every believer gets to have children or own land or anything like that. In fact, think of Naomi herself. At the end of the book, she's still a widow. Her sons are still gone. But her joy has been restored because she's seen God do marvelous things. At the beginning of the book, you might remember that Naomi felt like her life was empty. It's all gone. And she wanted to be renamed Mara because her life had become bitter. But how did the book conclude for Naomi? Let's read verse 16. Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap and became his nurse. The neighbor women gave him a name, saying, a son has been born to Naomi. So they named him Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. So here's Naomi. She's holding on to her grandson, Obed. And you know what the name Obed means? It means one who serves, or worshiper. Worshiper. Obed, he would end up serving Naomi in many ways, but in particular, he would help Naomi by restoring her spirit. I think his name at least partially represents what God has done spiritually in Naomi's life. In other words, Naomi felt empty at the beginning of the book, bitter, complaining about her life circumstances. But what is she now? She's a worshiper. She's a worshiper. Her hands, they're no longer empty. She has a daughter-in-law who the text says is better than seven sons, and she's holding on to tangible evidence that God deserves our praise and thanksgiving. Her hands were full of worship. She may not have a husband or her beloved Mahlon in Chilion, and we don't expect her to just get over it. But she's found reason to praise God through the trials. For the believer, there's always a reason to praise God. He's always doing good things in our lives. Sometimes we just need a little encouragement to trust in his nature, to recognize the good things that he's always doing in our lives and that he's already done in our lives. And a little help to align our wills with his definition of good. Not leaning upon our own understanding. And that's why I'm calling you this morning with my last point. To worship the Lord, just like Naomi and Ruth and Boaz. Because there's no one kinder than him. Strive to acknowledge God's kindnesses in your own life. So that you're giving him the praise that he deserves, not hanging on to bitterness. As we reach the conclusion of this book, what's even more incredible is that God wasn't just using these events to show kindness and compassion to Ruth and Naomi. He was even planning to show immense kindness to all of you sitting here today. Imagine that. This book is pointing to you here today. Because notice what the Lord ended up accomplishing through all of these events. As we read in verse 17, Obed became the father of Jesse, who was the father of David. In other words, Boaz and Ruth became the great-grandparents of King David. And so we shouldn't ever think that our pain is pointless. Certainly, Naomi and Ruth experienced real and painful loss. We don't want to diminish their loss. But God afflicted these ladies in order to accomplish an even greater kindness in and through their lives. Through them, the Lord would bring about Israel's greatest king. God was using these events to pour out his kindness upon an entire nation. And then as you observe the short genealogy which concludes the book, verse 18, here you see 10 names that lead from Perez all the way to David, including, obviously, Ruth's son, Obed. As you see this short genealogy, it should actually remind us that the book of Ruth is actually just a story within a story. Naomi and Ruth didn't know it at the time, but God was using their painful circumstances to show kindness to the entire world, to bring out the seed that would bless all the families of the earth, to even secure their own personal salvation and your eternal salvation for those who have believed in Jesus Christ. There is no kindness greater than this, God saving you through Jesus Christ, his son. How is Jesus Christ the greatest expression of God's kindness? Well, it's because through Jesus Christ, God isn't merely saving you from famine and starvation. He's saving you from an existence without the bread of life and the water of life. Through Jesus, God isn't just saving you from the sadness of being separated from loved ones in this world. He's saving you from the eternal misery of being separated from God forever. The fount of all joy. And Jesus Christ, he didn't just come to merely redeem a piece of land that had been sold. He came to purchase your soul. And that's necessary because if you don't have Jesus Christ this morning, It means that you owe a debt. You owe a debt because of your sin, because of the ways you've disobeyed God, because of how you've turned away from him. You must be punished. You must face his wrath for the rest of eternity. But Jesus Christ came into this world to pay your debt, so that you would be set free from sin's penalty, so that you would be set free from the death that you deserve. And if you cry out to Jesus Christ this morning, you can be saved. Believe in him as your Lord and Savior. Call out to him, and you could enjoy the sweet kindness of his saving grace this morning. There's no one kinder than the Lord. You can trust him this morning. Whatever you're going through as a believer, you can trust that he knows what he's doing, that he's always staying true to his good and faithful nature. Life may hurt, but don't let that tempt you to cast aside your faith. Do you think that God is actually done? Do you think he stopped working in your life because that event came into your life? That he just said, I'm done. Of course he's not done. If you're his child, he's never done with you. Just like Naomi, he wants to turn you into his worshiper. Will you become his worshiper this morning? Let's pray. Lord, you work in our lives to show us more of your glory. You did that with Ruth and Naomi. And even our own hardships, you're trying to show us more of yourself, more of your fullness, more of the joy that will stun us into the ages to come, more of the mercy, the grace that we don't deserve, but that you're going to shower us with forever. We love you, Lord. Help us to praise you in this last song. Amen.